2 years ago.
It was just over 2 years ago.
Yeah, it was January, end of January.
Was it Tuesday?
Unless it was really early in February.
It was Tuesday, the 4th of February, because that Saturday was the 1st of February. And we lost 1-0 to Wigan Athletic. And to add insult to injury, it was an own goal by Pablo Hernandez in the 59th minute.
I had a meeting in the morning, but nothing to do in the afternoon.
In the morning, I had year 12 for a double period, and we were doing Hamlet.
My meeting was in a smart, slightly scary office on Wardour Street.
It was either Hamlet or Macbeth.
I didn't think it would go anywhere, and it didn't.
But most likely it was Hamlet.
The woman promised she'd be in touch, and I never heard from her again.
After the break, I taught year 9. We finished reading of Mice and Men. I remember one lad in the class being really affected. He kept shaking his head and saying, "That ending, that ending."
After my meeting, I decided to walk from Soho to the South Bank, and that's when it started to snow.
At lunchtime, it started snowing. And my wife sent me a text message saying that we should get divorced.
I walked to the Tate Modern and I stayed there for hours.
In the staff room, I had a minor disagreement with a colleague. Called him a twat, which was an overreaction, and I still feel slightly bad about it.
In the turbine hall, one of the security guards asked me if I was all right, and I told her I was fine, and then she asked me why I was crying.
At the end of the day, I had a meeting with the parents of a Year 10 student called Chloe Green. Mother was nervous and defensive and talked too much. Dad barely said a word. Also present was the colleague who I'd called a twat, which was awkward.
I didn't tell the security guard that a few months earlier I'd experienced a small tragedy, because she almost certainly had her own share of tragedy to contend with. Although I suppose we could have stood there in the turbine hall swapping tragedies to make it fairer, but then she probably wouldn't have wanted to share the personal details of her life with me, would she? She was just being nice, which is probably part of her job. Maybe, I don't know. I apologised to her and I said I was fine, really, and she nodded like she knew that I wasn't.
That meeting with Chloe's parents stayed in my head because of what happened next.
When I came out of the Tate Modern, it stopped snowing, which was slightly disappointing. It must have been about 4:30 by then, 4:45 maybe. I walked to Waterloo Station, which never fails to make me think of ABBA.
By the time I left school, it stopped snowing. And this was vaguely disappointing.
My, my, at Waterloo, Napoleon did surrender. Oh, yeah, and I have met my destiny in quite a similar way. Ha! ABBA lyrics are actually quite weird. They're weird and really great.
I got to Waterloo about 5. Usually I caught the 1703, but it was cancelled.
The 1703 was cancelled.
So I had to wait for the 1727. I went to W.H. Smith's and bought a private eye.
I went to W.H. Smith's and bought a packet of Maltesers,
which I started reading and then had to stop because the litany of corruption was so depressing. Even more depressing than my wife's text message.
My sister texted me to ask when I would be back and did I want dinner.
My wife texted me again to say, did you get my message?
I'd been living with my sister for about 3 weeks at that point.
I didn't know what to say to her.
I was living with my sister because I'd recently returned from a 5-year stay in Denmark and I didn't have anywhere else to go.
Because there was no short answer.
I was in a transitional phase of my life.
And I couldn't be bothered to text the number of words that a long answer would require. Although maybe that would make a good novel. Husband replies to his wife's question about divorce in one long text. Or maybe not. Maybe it'd make a crap novel. Not that I want to write a novel. I don't even want to write a text, let alone a novel.
I found it difficult to be around my sister's children.
Both our kids were still at home.
There are 3 of them.
But our eldest was ready to go.
She has 2 girls and a boy, and they're loud, like really loud. The youngest one talks at a mile a minute and is obsessed with Marvel. But he's not actually allowed to watch any of the films because they're all rated at least a 12.
So our eldest, my son, was doing his last year of A-levels and my daughter was doing her first. My wife and I didn't know what they knew about how bad things had got and we didn't want to spell it out to them. We wanted to wait till our eldest had taken his A-levels. That was the plan.
I did actually have a plan. The plan was to find a job, find a flat, find a life, stay with my sister for 2 months, 10 weeks, 3 months at the absolute most.
I just turned 50, just before Christmas.
My sister is 3 years younger than me.
I'm a Sagittarius.
My sister is 3 years younger than me and a doctor, a consultant in intensive care whose husband is a neurosurgeon. A neurosurgeon, and they have 3 kids. I mean, come on.
I don't believe in it. Astrology. I don't believe in it, but I can tell you the star signs of most Premier League players. Not every single one, but all of Leeds United, obviously. Most of Man U, Man City and Liverpool. Rafinha's a Sagittarius, like me. Ilan Meslier is a Pisces. Calvin Phillips is also a Sagittarius, which makes me think that Sagittarians are just better at football than the rest of them. Although Mo Salah is a Taurus, so I don't know, that's where my theory falls apart.
At 17.23, they still hadn't announced the platform number.
At 17.24, they announced the platform.
And there's a rush of people.
I walk right to the end to try and get a seat. The platform's slippery. Like an accident waiting to happen.
There's a tiny bit of panic in the air.
There's a clock ticking.
I reach the last carriage.
There's no chance of a seat.
A minute to go and people are still getting on the train.
A whistle blows.
The train makes that noise that sounds like a warning about something more urgent than the fact that the doors are about to close.
At the last possible second, this young lad literally throws himself onto the train and his coat gets caught in the doors.
This man, this boy, gets his coat caught in the doors.
And he's breathing really hard like he's been running.
He tugs at it, but it won't come loose. He tugs at it again.
He kicks the door and swears.
When he kicks the door, everyone looks up from the phones.
The train hasn't moved yet.
Everyone is watching him. The train makes that sound again.
The doors reopen and he pulls his coat free.
The boy walks off down the carriage, pushing past a couple of people without apology. He disappears into the toilet at the end.
Then the train leaves the station in like juddering staccato kind of way, as if it's not quite sure it wants to go.
As the train leaves the station, I catch sight of myself in the reflection of the glass, looking ghostly, dressed for a funeral.
Everyone's gone back to their phones. Except me and this woman who's all in black, in a way that looks sort of religious or something.
My sister says I look like a nun.
I feel like I've seen her somewhere before.
The man standing opposite has a copy of Private Eye. He looks at me for a moment as if he might know me. It happens every now and again. Sometimes people start a conversation. But this man goes back to what he was reading.
I don't want her to think that I'm staring.
I like the fact that he reads Private Eye.
I try and concentrate on an article about the utterly horrific cladding fiasco.
There's this film from the 80s with Robert De Niro and Meryl Streep, and they fall in love on a commuter train. They're both married to other people, but Meryl Streep's husband seems like a bit of a git. Whereas Robert De Niro has two kids with his wife, and she seems really nice and like she really loves him. So hoping for Robert De Niro to get it together with Meryl doesn't feel right. But even so, when I think of that film, it does make me want to fall in love with someone I meet on a train. It just does.
Then she gets a nosebleed.
I've had nosebleeds all my life.
And for a second, I don't think she realises.
The man who's reading Private Eye is looking at me again. Like something's wrong. I put my hand to my face and I see blood.
I've got a serviette in my coat pocket, but it's been there all day and probably doesn't look all that appealing.
He offers me a serviette, which is exactly the same colour as the blood.
And it occurs to me that the serviette is the same colour as the blood. But I don't say that to her because I think that'll sound sort of sinister. I can't work out where I've seen her. And I can't ask her if we've met before, because that sounds sinister too.
There's dried blood on the back of my hand. I could try and rub it off, but I'd have to spit on the tissue, and I don't want to spit on a tissue in front of this man, because it's kind of disgusting.
I wonder if maybe she's just been to a funeral.
I thank him for the serviette.
I say, you're welcome.
He says, you're welcome. This is the first time I hear his voice, and he has a Yorkshire accent.
I'm about to ask, no matter how sinister it might sound, what the hell, have we met before? And then the door at the end of the carriage opens with a bang.
The boy walks back up the carriage.
The boy walks back up the carriage and comes and stands quite close to us, next to me. And he just stares at the woman who had the nosebleed.
This boy is red-haired and freckled. He has a bruise under one eye and he looks cold and underfed. I'm aware of him staring at me and I don't know whether to make eye contact and smile or just look away.
Something is about to happen.
I look away.
The boy says to her, he says, are you a nun? And she shakes her head and the boy says, well, you look like one. Then he says, can I ask you a question? And she says,
what's the question?
And he says,
do you think there's such a thing as evil?
And she says,
I don't know.
Then he says that she has to answer. She's not allowed to cop out.
So then I say, no, I don't. I mean, I don't think anyone is born evil, if that's what you mean.
Then the boy tells her that she's wrong. And he starts to kick the doors of the train really hard.
And then the man who gave me the serviette says something.
Hey.
The boy looks at him.
And the boy looks at me like, is that all you've got? Hey. I tell him he's going to break the doors. obviously he goes on kicking.
I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do.
No one else says a word. It's like they're all paralysed. It's just that we're the only ones directly involved and everyone else is glad to keep out of it.
And then he starts shouting about all sorts.
He just starts yelling.
About Jesus and being saved.
And then we stop. We just stop in a tunnel, which feels like really bad timing.
It's when the baby starts crying.
Further down the carriage by the other set of doors is a woman with a pram. And the baby starts crying, presumably because of all of this. And I'm thinking, if I pull the emergency cord, is that an overreaction?
He says he just wants to die.
The boy says he just wants to die.
And I don't ask why.
I don't ask him why.
I tell him I'll give him £10 if he stops kicking the door, and he looks surprised.
He stops immediately.
I find £10 in my wallet and he takes it. He takes it and walks away back down the carriage.
This sounds daft, but I almost feel like I've been in a fight.
I feel like I've been in a fight.
Not that I've ever actually been in a real fight.
I have actually been in a fight.
I mean, not really.
Just once. It was really horrible.
I want a drink.
I want a drink.
I want to go for a drink with her.
I want to talk about what just happened, but we're pulling into Richmond Station and I need to get off the train.
And she gets off the train at Richmond.
I smile at him in solidarity.
And she smiles at me.
He smiles back and I almost hug him. How ridiculous is that? God, thank God I didn't actually hug him.
She has a lovely smile.
He has a really bloody lovely smile.
Obviously, I thought I'd never see her again.
Obviously, I thought I'd never see him ever again.
But I did think about her.
I thought about him. A lot. Too much.
I couldn't even tell you why. I mean, I know why, but I just mean that it was such a brief, you know, interaction.
When I get back to my sister, she says, you didn't reply to my text.
I get home and my wife says, you didn't reply to my text. I tell her I didn't know what to say.
I don't tell my sister what happened on the train. She says there's no dinner for me and I tell her I'll just have Rice Krispies.
And that was early February.
So, yeah, that was early February or late January or early February, just before the world exploded.
I can't remember when exactly we started to pay attention to what was happening.
Was it bad in Italy then?
I think it was already bad in Italy.
I can't remember talking about it that much.
It was after the February half term. I think that's when the kids at school were starting to make jokes about it. In a nervous, excited kind of way. We had no idea.
We had no idea.
My wife and I were in this weird holding pattern. Everything was basically the same with this vague undercurrent of hostility.
During February and early March, I had a couple more meetings and two auditions, and I spent a lot of time explaining myself, where I'd been and why, and how I was back now and looking for work. And I wondered what the hell I was doing. And why I had ever thought for even a moment that this was going to work out. And by the end of February, I'd been at my sister's for 7 weeks and we were slightly hating each other. And then I got a job, a play, a great play, a decent part, not the lead, but still good, all good, starting in June, which didn't seem that far away. And I still had a tiny bit of money, enough for a rental deposit. So I started looking for a flat share in London. Which was slightly depressing at the age of 41. But on the other hand, it was more than slightly depressing living with my sister and her neurosurgeon husband and their three really loud kids. Also, just knowing that I should have been feeling more grateful to her made me feel it even less.
The second weekend in March, it was my dad's 79th birthday. And we were supposed to be driving up there for the weekend. I had a cold, felt a bit ropey, couldn't taste anything. But I had no cough.
My sister said we're right on the cusp.
My wife said, are you sure?
We're right on the cusp of catastrophe.
Yeah, pretty sure.
We're on the cusp of a catastrophe, she said. I replied that this was great alliteration and she looked at me and rolled her eyes.
I said, I'm pretty sure it's just a cold.
I can't remember when she started talking about PPE. Can it have been that early?
I said, I'm pretty sure it's just a cold.
I was still looking for a flat at that point, thinking I'd move out, thinking that I would do that play in June, thinking I could pick up where I left off 5 years ago before I gave up everything and moved to a foreign country and had a baby with a Danish cameraman.
We drove up to Leeds. My parents still lived in the house I grew up in. My daughter comes with us, but my son stays at home. My daughter bakes a lemon drizzle cake for her granddad and we drive up the M1 late on Friday night listening to Radiohead. My wife thinks they're miserable, but my daughter has decided they're the coolest band in the world and I'm delighted by this turn of events. It's a very nice weekend. My dad's on fine form. My mum's just happy we're there. And we all watched Leeds beat Huddersfield 2-1 on Saturday afternoon. Luke Ayling, a Virgo, scores in the 31st minute. And then Patrick Bamford, also a Virgo, scores in the 59th. We drive home late on Sunday. I'm worse by then, but I'm still feeling confident that it's just a cold. Monday morning I wake up, but I can't get out of bed. I'm completely poleaxed. I say to my wife, I'm pretty sure it's just the flu. My wife looks at me and I say, what? I still think it's not COVID. No one else in the house gets ill, so I think it's probably not. I think it's definitely just the flu. Although it's got to be the worst flu I've ever had in my life. 5 days later, I'm still in bed, feeling like death. And my mum calls and says, your dad's not right.
My sister's youngest, the one who's obsessed with Marvel, is called Sammy. He asks me if we're all going to die of the virus.
Your dad's not right.
I tell him we're not. I tell him it'll be okay. He looks at me like I'm an idiot, which seems now like a very reasonable response.
I ask her if she's called 111, and she says he's not got a cough. He's just not right. What's wrong with him? It's his breathing, she says. And I tell her to call 111 now, and then call me back when she's got through to someone.
My sister is on edge.
111 tell me, Mum, that if he doesn't have a cough, it's just a cold. They tell her to give him ibuprofen and paracetamol, but the virus is already burrowing to the cells of his upper respiratory tract and replicating.
To be honest, my sister is always slightly on edge, at least when she's talking to me. And sometimes when she's talking to her kids, and most of the time when she's talking to her husband, whose name is Mark. I can't work out what's going on with Mark, and I don't ask her because she wouldn't tell me. But I do wonder how she talks to her patients.
I recover. My dad goes downhill. My mum calls me every day. Sometimes even when I'm back at school and she knows I can't answer. She calls anyway and leaves these messages that are hesitant and hopeless, that tell me nothing. I want to go up there and be with her, be with him, but I can't go anywhere.
The schools close on the 20th of March, but my sister's children have to keep going because their mum is a doctor. They resent her for this. But then their dad is a doctor too, but they don't seem to resent him in the same way. The youngest one, the one who's obsessed with Marvel, asks why I can't homeschool them. Ha 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 ha, says my sister. Like she thinks I couldn't do it.
The schools close on the 20th of March and we all move on to online learning, which is frankly a shit show. At least at the beginning. A third of our kids have no Wi-Fi and no access to a laptop.
My sister keeps saying we're not ready.
On the 10th or 11th day, my dad seems to rally. But now we know what that means. It doesn't mean anything. It's the body fighting back, briefly deluded that it can win.
We're already in it, but we're not ready.
On the 13th day, my mum calls an ambulance. And they take his oxygen levels and they tell my mum she should have called them before now. Which I wish they hadn't said, because it still haunts her. They take him straight to hospital.
At this point, I still haven't found anywhere to live, and now it's harder to look. My sister tells me I can stay, but I can't tell if she actually wants me to stay or if she just feels obliged. I'm running out of money and I need a job, and it seems fairly obvious now that I won't be doing that play in June. I need to earn a living, but what can I do? What skills do I actually have? My life choices so far suddenly seem like an unambiguous disaster.
I FaceTime my dad. Very briefly, before they put him on a ventilator. I tell him I love him. Which I'm really glad I say. I want to say sorry too. I want to say sorry for bringing him this thing.
My sister comes home weeping with rage. There's not enough PPE, there's not enough beds, there's not enough ventilators. I feel useless, like I should do something useful, but what can I do?
He dies on the 7th of April. 28 days after he first felt poorly. He dies without any of his family with him. I cannot believe I will never hug him again. I cannot believe I've done this to him. I cannot bear myself.
I order a sewing machine and start making PPE and I get a job in the co-op.
A funeral on Zoom, it's a kind of horror. And if we can only have 10 people actually there, then how do we choose who gets to go?
In the beginning, I'm crap at making PPE and I'm awful at working the till. But I get better. I do get better.
There's a point at which my brother suggests that I shouldn't be allowed to be one of the 10. My mum defends me. My wife defends me. I mean, I can't not be there. I can't. I just can't. That'd kill me. I don't know why my brother's been like this. I mean, I do, but it's not like I knew. I didn't know. It's so easy in hindsight, isn't it? In hindsight.
Every now and again, someone recognises me, but they don't know who I am. They think that I'm someone they went to school with or someone they met at a party. I don't explain how it is they actually know me because it's a weird conversation to have at a checkout.
I would like someone to tell me that it's not my fault. And for that to be true, I would like to be able to sleep at night. I would like so much to watch Leeds run at home and then go for a pint with him. I would like that more than anything in the universe. Weirdly, during those first miserable months, the weather is glorious.
It's a really, really exceptionally beautiful spring.
I spend most of my days teaching a blank screen, because none of our kids, well, the ones who actually do have laptops, will switch their cameras on.
I drag my sister's kids out for walks, which they complain about.
Vulnerable kids are allowed to attend school alongside all the kids of essential workers. But so many of the vulnerable ones don't show up, including Chloe Green.
The gorgeous spring makes way for an equally lovely summer.
And 3 months after my dad's death, I suggest to my wife that we attempt some kind of reconciliation. I talk a lot, which I don't usually do. I'm aiming for something epic and grand. I use a lot of words. I talk about hope and life and heartbreak and the kids. And I think if I just keep talking that something will happen, that something will change. And it works. It works like magic.
At the beginning of the summer holidays, my sister's husband leaves a note on the kitchen table saying that he needs a break. And it turns out he's gone on holiday without them. And that's about the time my sister starts to have a nervous breakdown. And I can't complain about it because she's a doctor and I'm not a doctor. I'm someone who used to be an actor who now works in the co-op and creates homemade PPE. On a particularly bad day, sometime in August, we have an argument. I can't remember how it starts, but we end up arguing about the fact that I think that she thinks I'm useless, and it ends with my sister yelling at me that I'm fine and I'm alive and I should be more bloody grateful about it.
My brother isn't speaking to me, and my mum's loneliness makes me feel horrifically guilty. But my relationship with my wife has suddenly improved no end. In fact, we're almost happy.
When my sister's husband comes back from holiday, he has a suntan, and only me and the youngest one are at home. And I ask him where he went, and he says, Puerto Plata. The youngest one calls him a bastard and tells him that he's worse than Thanos from the Marvel films. I agree about the bastard bit. Maybe not the Thanos bit, since Thanos destroyed half of the universe just by clicking his fingers. A few days later, my sister's husband moves out on a permanent basis.
In September, after the astounding fiasco of the exam results, we're back at school.
Me and the eldest one take over the kitchen completely, and we start to experiment with food. Sometimes we're successful, sometimes less so. One night, my sister says, this is inedible, which it is, or was. Me and Sammy go out late at night and buy fish and chips for everyone. Sammy's already in his PJs and wrapped up in his Marvel dressing gown. And when we bring the fish and chips home, just for that evening, we're all incredibly happy.
Back at school, we're braced for more fantastically incompetent leadership from Gavin Williamson, who used to sell fireplaces for a living before he was in charge of education. But me and my wife are still getting along, so I feel like I can't complain about anything else in case I jinx it.
In October, the government produced a poster telling ballet dancers to retrain in cyber. I imagine the blood, sweat and tears that goes into ballet training. And doing all that and then getting told to go and start again somewhere else as something else. Also, what if she's no good, this imaginary ballet dancer at cyber?
November and December are bleak.
January and February are just awful.
After Christmas, the kids go back to school for one day only before the government change their minds and send everyone home. The incompetence beggars belief. Except, of course, we're getting used to it, because it's been nearly a year.
My sister's kids are back to being at school while hardly anyone else's are. The older two are okay with it, but Sammy really doesn't want to do this all over again. And I find myself saying, what if I did it? What if I homeschooled the kids? Why the hell would you do that, says my sister. Not forever, I say, just for a bit, just for this lockdown. I cut back on my shifts at the co-op and homeschool Sammy 2 days a week. This is how we get through winter.
Somehow we get through winter.
When the spring comes, we can't believe it's been a year.
My wife says she can't believe it's been a year.
My sister asked me if I'll raise the kids if anything happens to her. I say, nothing's going to happen to you. She says, anything could happen to me. I say, if something happened to you, I'd kill myself. She says, you can't kill yourself if anything happens to me because I need you to raise the children. I realise that she is asking me this 13 years into raising a family. In which case, who did she ask before? Who did she ask before? Mark's brother, apparently.
The first anniversary of my dad's death comes around. I call my mum. She says she's doing okay. She never says anything different to that, so there's almost no point asking. Except there is, of course, because you've got to. Because you can't not. But sometimes I wish she'd have a go at me. I wish she'd say, yes, I do blame you, I do. I wish you'd never come up on his birthday. I wish you'd stayed at home, you stupid bastard. Except my mum would never swear. My mum flinches when anyone swears, like she's been physically struck.
In April, this is the second April now, my sister apologises for what she said last August, and I know immediately what she's talking about. She means for saying that I should be more grateful that I'm alive. And then she tells me that she forgot about Isaac. She forgot about Isaac. Don't do that again, I say. She says she won't, and then she's crying again. She never used to cry before, and now she cries all the time.
3 days after the anniversary of my dad's death, Leeds beat Man City. 2-1. Stuart Dallas scores in the 42nd minute, and again in the 91st. Man City have 29 shots and 72% possession. Leeds have only 2 shots, and both of them are goals. I don't even believe in God, and I don't believe in heaven. But I can't believe that my dad didn't see that match. I mean, I literally can't believe it. Because I think he did. Somehow, like, his spirit came back to earth. Because I could feel him smiling all day. His joy in that 91st minute. And the fact that it was Man City at home. Home, for God's sake. Stuart Dallas is an Aries, by the way.
Sometimes I think I see glimpses of Isaac in my sister's youngest, Sammy. I don't know if I'm just imagining it, if I'm just wishing for it. But I'm sure Isaac did have a look of Sammy. And I can imagine them together and people who don't know them asking, are they brothers? And me saying no, but they are cousins. And people, whoever these people are, saying to me, they've got a look of each other. And me nodding, pleased.
The second spring is not nearly so good as the first.
The second summer is rubbish.
In terms of weather?
We get a lot of rain.
It seems to piss it down almost daily.
In June, my supervisor at the co-op asks me if I'm interested in their management programme, and I start laughing because I honestly think that they're joking. But they mean it. They actually mean it.
And that speech, my big speech about life and heartbreak, the magic of it starts to wear off. And suddenly my relationship with my wife seems to be like it's on the slide.
I asked my sister if she thinks I should train to be a manager at the co-op. And she asked me if that's really what I want to do with my life. And I tell her I have no idea what I want to do with my life. Because the truth is that I've been completely lost since Isaac.
Over that spring or that summer we give up the ghost. Or the ghost gives up on us.
I really need a plan. I do.
In the second September of the pandemic, my daughter starts university. And suddenly, me and my wife are rattling around the house. What happened? She asked. What happened to you? I don't know what she means. She says, I've stopped talking again. that I never used to talk, and then all of a sudden after my dad died, I started, and it was amazing. And she never felt so connected, and she never felt less alone. But now, apparently, I've shut down again. I apologise. Tell her that I didn't mean to. Shut down, I mean.
In the 2nd October, I come home from work and Mark's there, sitting on their very nice settee with the kids, watching Iron Man, the cartoon. I go into the kitchen and my sister is attempting to cook. Mark's here, I tell her, like she doesn't already know, but of course she knows. Is he back, I ask. Says my sister, What the hell, I want to say? But I can't say that. Well, I could, but I don't. Is he back? I don't know, she says. I don't know. I say, he looks quite comfortable. Well, it is his house, she replies. I look at her and she looks at me. What? She says, it is. And I want to say, but for God's sake, he went on holiday without you all in the middle of a bloody pandemic.
Towards the end of the 2nd November, they start talking about Omicron.
In the 2nd December, there's talk of illegal Christmas parties being held at number 10 during the 1st December. There's an unscheduled statement by the Prime Minister straight after the semi-finals of Strictly. His intonation is warlike, but he hasn't even brushed his hair.
My mum comes down to us for Christmas. It's our 2nd Christmas without my dad. I tell her that me and Louise are separating. Thank God for that, says my mum. And her relief surprises me. It turns out that she knew all along. How did she know? How did you know? You never look happy anymore, she says. And I said, but that's because of Dad. And she says, you haven't looked happy for years. Years before Dad. And I thought I was so good at hiding it.
Mark comes round on Christmas Day. And I like it less than the Christmas we had the year before, when it was just me and my sister and the kids. And I realise that I really do need to move out, because I've become a kind of second dad. And now their real dad is back. He's moving back in by stealth, and I need to get out of the way. And I don't want to be a dad anyway. I want to be a mother. Or I wanted to be, but I think that ship has sailed. Funny phrase, that. I like it, though. We get through a 2nd January.
We get through a 2nd January. With more revelations about leaving drinks and birthday parties at number 10. One Tory MP says these lockdown breaches are not that bad, that they're the equivalent of parking on a double yellow line. And I'm thinking, I did not get to say goodbye to my father because of these rules. These rules that they told us mattered, that did matter, but not to them.
We all get Omicron.
We all get Omicron.
We all get over Omicron.
We get over Omicron. And I need to find somewhere to live.
I really need to find somewhere to live.
On Monday the 14th of February, the weather's nothing special.
On Monday the 14th of February, I go and look at a flat in East London.
Even though it's half term, I go into school. I don't register what day it is until the caretaker wishes me a happy Valentine's. It rains all afternoon.
I don't know how I'm planning to pay for the room in this flat, which is no bargain, or how I'm going to commute to my job at the Co-op from East London, but the flat belongs to a friend of a friend, and it sounds lovely, and I just want to take a look, see if I can figure something out. I take a look at the flat, and it's even nicer than I hoped, and I can imagine living there.
I leave school at around 4:45. It stopped raining. The sky's gorgeous, that half light.
I'm at Waterloo Station waiting for the 1703 when I see him.
I recognise her immediately.
I'm not completely sure that it's him until he speaks.
And I want to say hello, but I've no idea if she'll remember me, and I don't want her to think I'm a nutter. Then she smiles.
He smiles back.
It's such a bloody lovely smile.
Hi.
Hi.
It's you, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. From the train?
Yeah.
Like 2 years ago?
Yeah, God, how weird.
Yeah, really weird.
I've been thinking about you for 2 years.
Really?
I've been thinking about that day, that moment. Not just you, obviously. I mean, it was a mad moment.
It was.
It really freaked me out.
You were great, though.
Oh, I don't think I was.
No, you were.
No, I wasn't, because he said that awful thing.
I just want to die.
Yeah, and I didn't ask him why.
I didn't ask him why either.
No, but I sort of paid him off, didn't I? Like, I paid him to go away.
I didn't see it like that at all.
I did. I felt really bad about it since. It was just when that baby started crying and we were in that tunnel. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
I thought, I've got to do something, but... I mean, he needed help. He needed so much more than 10 quid.
Well, yeah, but you could... How could you provide that in that moment? Well, it's not your fault they dismantled the welfare state, is it?
No.
Unless you're a key member of Whitehall.
I'm not.
Didn't think so.
But I could have asked him why. I could have.
So could I.
I was frightened.
It was frightening. Also, being in an enclosed space like that.
Yeah, but nothing really happened. No one got hurt or anything.
No, but in that moment, we didn't know what was going to happen, did we?
Yeah, I wish I'd asked him. I wish I could go back. I would change that if I could. I would ask him next time. I would.
I know that feeling, I do. But you've got to try and not carry that around with you.
Well, yeah, anyway. I hope he's okay. I hope it got better for him.
Well, might have done.
But probably not.
You don't know. It might.
It's so funny seeing you.
I know.
I can't believe it, really. I mean, I've thought about you loads. I know I shouldn't say that because it does sound really weird.
I don't mind you saying that.
But now you're here.
Here I am, where I always am.
Is this your commute then?
Yeah.
So you're like here every day at this time, kind of time?
Yeah.
So I could have found you easily?
Yeah. I suppose you could, if you were lucky.
I just really wanted to talk to you after what happened.
Yeah. Me too, actually. I almost said at the time, and then I just thought, no, it'll sound...
What did you want to say?
I suppose I just felt like I wanted to go for a drink, and ideally I wanted to go for that drink with you, but it didn't necessarily feel like the right thing to do, you know, to ask you.
But I would have said yes, I think.
Would you?
I think so.
So, where are you, what train are you on?
The 1703.
Oh, me too.
I'm just going home.
Me too.
I live with my sister, but I need to move out. That's what I was doing this afternoon. I was looking for a place to live.
Was it any good?
Yeah, lovely.
So, do you need to get back to your sister's urgently?
No. She's reuniting with her not very nice husband, so I'm in no rush. They do quite a lot of kissing at the moment in front of me and the kids, which is a bit unbearable.
What, in front of your kids?
No, her kids. I don't have any kids, so... Well, I did have a kid once. I had a baby called Isaac, but he was stillborn, and then me and his dad split up, and that was a few months, actually, before that day on the train, so I was a bit... I was in a bit of a state then. I was in mourning.
You were in black.
I was, yeah. Sorry.
What are you sorry for?
You know, just crying.
It's fine. It's absolutely fine.
Thank you.
I'm really sorry about Isaac.
Thanks. We should have called him Enzo, but we chickened out. I really wanted to call him Enzo. I wish I had, in a way.
Well, they're both really good names.
Jesus.
That's a good name too.
Yeah. What about you?
Me?
What's your name?
Oh, yeah, I'm Ray.
I'm Krista.
Krista?
Yeah.
What you were saying before about, like, if you could go back, my dad died quite soon after that day on the train. Because, you know, it wasn't that long, was it, before the world exploded. And so... I had COVID in early March, and I gave it to my dad.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And I killed him, basically.
You didn't kill him.
I did, though. I did. Because if we hadn't gone up to see him...
Oh, but you didn't know.
I thought it was a cold.
Ray.
So I've been feeling like shit about that, ever since.
I'm really sorry.
And I, also, split up with my wife.
Right.
So, you know, I'm just, you know...
Describing the last, couple of years.
Exactly, yeah.
It's been awful. It's been so awful.
I know, yes. And we, all right, I shouldn't speak for you. I count myself as one of the lucky ones.
Yep.
I mean, I've still got a job. People haven't got jobs.
What do you do?
I'm an English teacher.
Really?
What?
Well, I don't know. Well, I didn't think you'd be a teacher.
Well, what did you think I'd be?
I don't know. No, you look too interested to be a teacher. Oh, my God, sorry, that's a really terrible thing to say.
Yeah, well, thanks a lot.
I'm really sorry.
What do you do, then?
Oh, don't ask me that.
Okay.
But I used to be an actor, but I gave up acting to move to Denmark, which was probably quite stupid. But at the time, I was feeling quite disillusioned with the industry, like I'd had a couple of, you know, bad experiences. One really bad experience with, a man, a bloke, a person, a producer. So I was already not sure if I wanted to carry on. And then this really beautiful Danish cameraman was all like, do you want to go and live with me in the middle of nowhere and have a baby? And I said, yes, that sounds great. And then it took a long time to have a baby. And, well, you know how that ended, because I've already told you. God, I can't believe how much I've told you. And, oh, my God, I've known you for about 3 minutes.
Yeah, but in a way, you've known me for 2 years.
I mean, not really.
But I do feel like I know you.
Yeah, I feel like I know you too. But I don't, and you don't know me either.
Well, yep, that is a good point.
Anyway, yeah, so for the last 2 years, I've been working in a supermarket, doing various other voluntary things, and homeschooling my nephew, Sammy, who I adore. And that's it, really.
Right.
Is that really disappointing?
No, not at all. Don't be daft, but now I know why you look familiar.
Yeah, well, it was years ago.
I don't think you should give it up. Do you really want to do that?
Yeah, because it doesn't help anyone.
That's not true.
It's totally true. I've never felt more useless than I've felt in the last 2 years.
But it sounds like you've been doing loads.
Well, yeah, loads of actual useful things as opposed to acting.
Do you miss it?
Yes.
Do you love it?
I did. I used to.
But you could love it again, surely?
I don't know. My sister's a doctor.
Yep, with a husband who's not very nice.
But she's got lovely kids.
Anyway, what's your sister being a doctor got to do with you being an actor?
I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm five, but she's better than me, basically.
That's bollocks.
No, you should meet her.
I don't need to meet her.
Hang on a sec.
What?
Have we missed our train?
Yes. Yes, we have. Yeah. I mean, we could always...
What?
Go for that drink we maybe should have gone for 2 years ago.
We could.
Do you want to?
I'd love to.
Well, let's go then.
Okay.
Okay.
In Waterloo Station by Katie Hymns, Krista was played by Christine Bottomley and Ray was played by Ralph Einstein. The director was Mary Peake.